George pulled me into the room with Steve Jobs as they were screaming at each other about whether Steve would wear a suit or his Apple t-shirt. And I can tell you after an hour, actually, George Quist won that, you know.
Really?
Yes, he went, which is amazing, right? It's probably the first concession and only one that Steve Jobs ever made.
I'm Scott McGrew. Welcome to Sand Hill Road.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Annie Lamont is an important figure in venture capital. She's an important figure in something else, much to my surprise. I'll get to that later in the podcast, but here's a quick excerpt.
The person who introduced you and me did not mention this to me. And
no, funny.
You know what? It took a while. The Google on it, you know, I mean, you are such an, you're such a good investor and you've done so well as an investor that it doesn't pop up immediately.
I promise. We'll get to that later. Annie Lamont is co-founder of Oak FTHC, and I wanted to get her take on what she thought was ahead for 2022. I was trying to figure out how to explain who Lamont is when I came across this old clipping in the New York Times. Lamont, they write, is one of the most successful women in the ever lofty realm of venture capital.
I think I'm going to start calling it the ever lofty realm of venture capital from here on out.
I love that moniker too.
So secondly, what do you think of what they said?
What do I think? Well, you know, it was interesting. That was 15 years ago, I think they wrote that. And I guess what I would say is I never really liked the qualification of women venture capitalists. I guess I'd like to.
Right. You are one of the most successful people in venture capital. Forbes put you in the top 50. National Venture Capital Association says you're one of the top investors in healthcare ever.
Well, thank you. So I will let other people say that, but I think at this point, having the qualification, given how many women, and especially 15 years ago, were actually in venture capital industry, I didn't feel that it was actually a great shout out.
So talk to me about 2022. 2021, a banner year in funds invested, but also funds raised. A lot of money in venture capital in 2021. Big funds making big rounds. What do you think is ahead?
Well, you're right. We've raised an extraordinary amount of capital as an industry globally. And, you know, people have to put it to work. But I do believe that 2022, the pace will slow down.
And why is that?
And I think it's because first of all, look at the public markets. And usually there's a lag of 6 to 9 months between what happens in the private markets and the public markets. And I'm sure the first quarter may be more positive in terms of the public markets correcting. But I think you're in this period where people are separating the wheat from the chaff. And they're trying to figure out what's great, what's not. And there will be, and right now they're just funding everything at high prices, right? In the venture, in all the way from early seed to late stage growth. And I do think there will be separation and a more discerning investor out there, as particularly.
But what causes that? What causes? Many things to laugh at out there these days.
Right. I mean, no, it's incredible.
But what makes us get more serious?
The Coatues and Tigers and others, you know, that are in the public markets as well as the later stage and now earlier stage privates. You know, when 75% of IPOs are underwater, and stock portfolios have gone down, then people are a little less bullish about what's happening in the private market. And they shouldn't be less bullish from the quality, from the tailwinds, the quality of the entrepreneurs and the companies and what's going on. But, you know, valuations have certainly peaked. I think you could call the fourth quarter perhaps a peak in the market.
So sobriety is a natural just outcome of 2021 in 2022, because people did get burned. Then they're going to look more carefully?
I think they will look more carefully. I do still think the great companies will still command tremendous valuations. Particularly, I mean, if you look at global opportunities in fintech, I mean, there will be companies created now that have $20 to $100 billion market caps in the future. There will be great healthcare companies created. So I think that, capital will flow to those opportunities. But that does reduce returns for everybody in these great companies.
The name of your firm, Oak HCFT, that's going to be healthcare and fintech, right? Those are your two areas of focus.
They are.
Is it because there's so much ahead that is so untapped, or because the returns are so good, or all of the above?
Well, we chose these two areas really 20 plus years ago. And there were two highly regulated areas that you really needed to deeply understand to not get burned. And we felt like healthcare needed, there was incredible opportunity. It's 20% of the economy. Payment and fintech, you could say, touches everything. And there were very few players in 2002 when we started doing fintech before we created Oak HCFT even. There were very few players in it. So it was an incredible time to establish a position, knowledge, and then build a team over the last 70 years. The tailwinds, you know, have arrived in both of these sectors. And it's incredible to see the inflection point of in not just investing, but really growth of these companies and demand for their services.
As you know, any shop now is interested in healthcare and fintech. I'm guessing you think your experience gives you quite a leg up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think if you talk to our entrepreneurs, we are incredibly helpful and supportive of our entrepreneurs. And I think just we have so many repeat entrepreneurs, probably about 30% of what we do is just repeat entrepreneurs that we've backed before, you know, that keep coming back to us. I think our ability to connect them not only with customers, but we have five people that are dedicated to healthcare and fintech and talent. And so talent alone, like we spend every day just talking to people who understand both of these sectors. The best testimonial will come from our entrepreneurs.
I saw that statistic that roughly one third of your investments are repeat entrepreneurs, because that makes sense. If you know that they're successful, that they do well, that they're a good team, why wouldn't you? But the flip side of that would be what we call pattern matching, right? That you invest in what you know. Now, to be fair, that also means that two-thirds of your investments are not pattern matching.
That is true, at least people-wise. But there's pattern matching in terms of the type of entrepreneur, the business model, you know, the knowledge of the individual areas and the sectors.
One of the things with healthcare in particular are Google and Amazon being very, very interested in it. And you had said that do you think that Google and Amazon coming into the healthcare industry is generally good? Why is that?
Oh, I think it's great because I think they have different skill sets than entrepreneurs, and they have different resources. They can invest in different things that aren't necessarily, you know, available to entrepreneurs. Now, do I think, you know, Google hasn't really made an impact in healthcare, to tell you the truth? They don't even know how to play. They're trying to play. They can play on the life sciences side because they have great resources there and a huge amount of, you know, dollars to put behind things. But I think Amazon, what they're leveraging their strengths in terms of distribution. But there's so many areas in healthcare that they won't be able to do that with. I do not worry about any of the tech companies in terms of competition for our entrepreneurs.
I want to circle back to a question I had missed when we were talking about predicting 2022. As we look ahead to 2022, can you throw out any sort of, you know, black swan sort of disruptions that might worry you? If we were doing this in 2019, we would not have guessed global pandemic.
Right.
Some people actually did. But are there things that on your, though they wouldn't be on your radar because it's a black swan, but but something that would really throw off what you're trying to do?
Well, I think, you know, there's small things that become big things, like CMS saying that they're not going to reimburse telehealth in the same way they do in person. That would dramatically change many of the models and the progress that's been made. I think particularly you think about virtualization and treating people at home. And so that would be a negative. And then obviously in crypto, you know, we're all waiting, you know, we're waiting in blockchain and crypto and, you know, to what the regulations are going to be. And I'm not overly worried. I mean, I think right now they're probably going to be judicious and hopefully smart about how they do this. But if they, you know, and I think what would happen if they dramatically, you know, if they really shut things down or they said, you know, stablecoin couldn't be a thing, that people would just move offshore. So they would just push innovation off the, you know, out of the United States, and we'd probably just be doing more investing offshore.
Is there an advantage to working in industries like healthcare and fintech that are so highly regulated? I mean, beyond the returns, but the fact that they are regulated?
Yeah, I think there is probably the guidelines are more, are better understood. I think it's a competitive advantage because we understand the regulatory environment and the regulators so well. So I feel like we've got pretty good insight into what they will and won't be doing, which I think is helpful if you're going to play in these areas. And I think when people first started coming into healthcare, you know, they were, you know, this saying in Silicon Valley, right? You ask forgiveness as opposed to permission. And we're very much we're going to ask for permission before, you know.
That is such an extraordinary, you think of maybe Uber as being the opposite of that we'll break the rules and create the industry and government will come around eventually. And in healthcare, no, you don't do that.
No, you're dealing with people's lives. So there's actually a reason that there's a regulatory environment that matters. One of the driving reasons that I was excited about investing in healthcare was that I actually had to drop out of Stanford my junior year because my mother called me. My father was ill. He was running his own business. And if he didn't work, he didn't make money. And we didn't have any health insurance. So I had to go back to Wisconsin. I worked for a quarter. I went to University of Wisconsin-Madison for a summer to make up credits. And then miraculously, they were able to send me back to Stanford in the fall. But it was a hell of a lesson to me. And I found out later my dad cashed in his life insurance in order to, you know, put me back in school. And, you know, so there are two things really resonated. One, the cost of education, obviously where we're at, and the cost of healthcare and accessibility. And, you know, so I really, in 2000, I just said, after doing a lot of biotech investing, I just want to focus on lowering costs and improving quality and access in healthcare. It's just it's a real passion of mine and very, very personal to me.
It is certainly one of the biggest challenges, no matter where you land on the political spectrum. One of the biggest challenges is you know, healthcare for all at a reasonable price, which is not a crazy thing to ask for.
It's not a crazy thing to ask for. No, it isn't. You know, and it's sort of like, you know, the government is actually providing subsidies right now. And so exchanges are less expensive. But the reality is that doesn't mean the cost of healthcare is lower. That just means consumers are paying less. It's great that consumers are paying less, but we have, you know, we really need to move the dial in lowering the ultimate cost of healthcare. And it is the exciting part about what's happened with COVID in that moving to more virtualization, moving people out of institutions, out of nursing homes, having more things done at home versus in the hospital or in clinics, you know, you are automatically going to lower the cost of care.
Do you feel that Washington is coming along? I know here in Silicon Valley, we sometimes point and giggle at the Senate hearings where the senator doesn't quite understand what, you know, instant messaging is or whatnot. But do you think Washington in general, and I realize there's, you know, an administration side with FDA and then there's Congress and whatnot, but in general, do you think U.S. government is beginning to understand how exciting some of this healthcare could be ahead?
I think that as a topic, nobody actually wants to touch healthcare right now. So I actually don't think there'll be much reform or innovation. I just hope that the administration doesn't get in the way of what's already happening, right? And supports virtualization and supports some of the programs that have begun. I do think that you know, the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare. I mean, I think that had a big impact on Biden. And I think he has so many other issues to deal with. I just think healthcare is, you know, like not on the list of priorities.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
How'd you get your start in venture capital?
When I got out of Stanford, it was an incredible moment in Silicon Valley. And it was really the beginning of the explosion. And through a friend, I was introduced to a investment bank, a boutique investment bank that also did venture. And in my first 3 months there, we took Apple public. I carried Steve Jobs' bag on the Apple IPO roadshow. And we took Genentech public. So that's how I really got introduced to biotech.
That's a damn good start to the venture capital
industry.
It was
an amazing start. I couldn't believe these entrepreneurs. I was absolutely mesmerized and excited about working with them. And I, you know, literally like 6 months into my work life, I said, I want to be a venture capitalist. I could imagine nothing more exciting for the rest of my life to just be working with entrepreneurs. So I, a year and a half in, I told everybody I knew, this is what I wanted to do. And luckily one of those people talked to the original Oak founder, and he hired me, and rest is history. I moved to Westport, Connecticut, met my husband, and it was just karma.
So when you say you carried Steve Jobs' bags, this is not a metaphor for something.
No.
You physically carried his bags.
Physically, I did. I carried like the handheld written presentations, you know.
Right, on the Apple Roadshow. Just give me a taste of what
Apple
that was
Roadshow.
Like.
Yeah, you know, I'm 22 years of age. And
Steve Jobs is wearing a suit.
No, well, yeah, you know, he's wearing a suit. But that was actually my most interesting moment on the whole roadshow was with George Quist, the other founder, Hamburg Quist. George pulled me into the room with Steve Jobs as they were screaming at each other about whether Steve would wear a suit or his Apple t-shirt. And I can tell you after an hour, actually, George Quist won that, you know.
Really?
Yes, he won, which is amazing, right? It's probably the first concession and only one that Steve Jobs ever made. But it is funny, right? Because you would actually see Steve in a suit, you know, from then on. And then you saw, obviously, his black outfit. But It was amazing to see the intensity of Steve Jobs. That, you know, he was only a year and a half older than I was. It was a wake up call.
I met him in the late 90s when he had just come back to Apple Computer, and you knew that he was smart, and you knew that he definitely knew he was intense. But even at that time, you know, Apple was not a very valuable company. People were thinking about breaking it up, for goodness sakes. We had no idea it would be the most valuable company in the world, or the iPhone was not even a glint in his eye at that point. What did you sense about the two of them and the company back then, other than just intensity? Did you know that, hey, someday this is going to be the most valuable company in the world?
I think he still stands as the most impressive entrepreneur I'd ever met. And I think it is the passion, the intensity, the conviction he had, just in the vision, right? I mean, it was just, he was painting a vision then that was maybe not iPhone apps, but similar, like just, he was going to move the world. And he just, he needed to grow up as a manager, you know, and he ended up doing that and understanding his strengths and weaknesses, you know, over the next decade, which, you know, was incredible when he returned to Apple to create what he did. And I keep wondering as I, you know, I use Apple TV, like, what would that look like? What would it look like today if Steve Jobs were still around? I mean, it's pretty great, but it would be better, right? It would be better.
No question. So, you know, I was laughing when you said, you know, when I got into venture capital and my first two companies that I dealt with were Apple and Genentech. you got into venture capital at a time when women were very rare in venture capital. What have you learned or what advice do you give young women these days, as it is, obviously much more common these days, but what sort of wisdom do you pass down?
Well, it did take 30 years, but I do feel like, one thing that's happening is that women are much more aware of the industry. So they're coming into it early. You know, as we recruit people, I mean, it was just not on their minds even a decade ago. And now women do see it as a career path. And, you know, one thing I do say is you don't have to have a female mentor. You just have to, for me, I took pieces of people I respected, you know, and modeled off of, you know, different characteristics of different people. And so I think, you know, that's the thing you do is you find different mentors, but you really just incorporate those things that you respect in the people around you to, you know, really, and then obviously put your own take on it. And, you know, and that's really how you build a career and create your own path.
Normally, I would not care at all what a woman's husband did for a living. But the fact that the person who introduced you and me did not mention this to me. And you know what? It took a while. The Google on it, you know, I mean, you are such a good investor and you've done so well as an investor that it doesn't pop up immediately, you know, what your husband does for a living. After all, you are one of the most successful women in the ever lofty realm of venture capital. But in this case, I do want to ask about your second job.
Yeah.
You're the first lady of Connecticut.
That is true.
I've never talked to a first lady of a state before, I don't think.
We're a rare breed.
Yeah. Well, there are only 50 of you. There are less than 50 because we've got women governors. A first spouse. Yes. I've never talked to a first spouse before. Is that something that consumes a lot of time or does it come up? Is it relevant? I mean, like I said, most people, you shouldn't care what the spouse does for a living. Right. But in this case, it's sort of interesting.
Well, I think what's beautiful about it, I was a political science major at Stanford. So I do have an interest in the topic. And I think it's one of the reasons Ned and I were attracted to each other is that we, you know, love, talk, you know, the issues. But I think he's found his calling and I found mine. And I think that the great thing about the first lady position in Connecticut or the first spouse is that nothing really is expected of you. And so you can make it what you want it to be. And, you know, in our case, we have very full lives and he runs a state and I run a firm. I think that when we talk about healthcare issues, you know, when there are things that I can help him with, absolutely. You know, I'm happy to give my opinion.
Healthcare in Connecticut, actually, I jotted this down. Connecticut consistently rates at the top or near the top on vaccinations. And lows in hospitalizations and deaths. Obviously, these numbers move back and forth a lot. But is it something that your state has done properly? Is it the type of person who lives in Connecticut? What is the size? Obviously,
yeah. Very no, high, no. I you think know. you're hitting on all good points. I think there are a couple of things. I think that we do have a highly educated population. And I think we have a not particularly polarized population. So I think that's helpful. I also think my husband has helped that in the sense that he has tried to, through common sense, you know, deliver messages not a really mandate, and simply, you know, govern through common sense. And I do think it's interesting. We have a fabulous chief operating officer of the state who did happen to be one of my CEOs of one of my companies, in Connecticut. And we recruited him, you know, the very first days. And that's one thing I love about what we've done is it's a wonderful, what he's done in his administration is a mix of people who understand government and there, but we've got a former Goldman Sachs partner running economic development. We have a former entrepreneur who was at IBM before that, running information and being the COO of the state. And since he knew healthcare, it was great to have his support in literally driving testing sites and then vaccinations. And so, I think they've done a great job in terms of, making things available, operationally running things well. I think my husband's communicated well. People seem to like the way he's done it. I do. But I do think we have like an unbelievably great population that is pulled together. And like some states have been very, divisive and lots. And this is now, I think people are really, they're all in and they're really proud of Connecticut. They're proud of the fact we do have the highest vaccination rate. They're proud of the fact that we've handled it well and smartly, and not just we being meaning the governor's administration, meaning the citizens of Connecticut.
Annie Lamont, co-founder and managing partner at Oak HCFT. Next week on Sand Hill Road, Nicole Quinn of Lightspeed Venture Partners.
Somebody told me you are the fastest English woman alive.
Did Jeremy Lou tell you that?
Maybe.
Sand Hill Road is produced by Sean Myers under the leadership of Sarah Bueno and Stephanie Adruni. For more interviews with Silicon Valley's most influential entrepreneurs, check me out on TV at Press Here. That's Sunday mornings on NBC Bay Area and everywhere in the world on iTunes and at PressHereTV.com.